Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC Studios, I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast. It's Wednesday, April 24th. This is a day off in the Trump hush money trial, and we'll break down the evidence so far with Politico reporter Erica Ordon, who's been in the courtroom for the opening arguments and the start of first witness, David Pecker, former publisher of the National Enquirer, who had this deal with Trump to make up fake news stories about his opponents in 2016 and to catch and kill, as they call it, stories from women alleging sexual encounters with Trump. The court has also released data about the jurors, about their media diets, without naming names, of course, but it's where these jurors say they get their news. And it's really interesting and surprising in some ways. One spoiler, one of the jurors cited WNYC as one of their sources of news, but it's interesting what else that juror takes in. We'll get to that. Again, Erica Ordon, reporter for Politico, is our guest. Erica, always good to have you on. Thanks for taking some of this day off from the courtroom to be with us. Welcome back to WNYC.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
How much of the proceedings have you been there for in person so far?
All of them. During jury selection, the setup was that most of the reporters, except for a very, very small rotating group, were in an overflow room watching a closed circuit video feed. And then I was part of the small group that rotated into the main corporate room at that point during jury selection. And once jury selection finished, there's a much larger group of reporters who, including myself, who have been sitting in the main courtroom.
Cool. So about these jurors and their media diets, let's do this piece first. Before I go into the details, why is this public about the survey of their news media habits?
Well, a lot of the information about jurors is public. Their names are not. Certainly. And at some point in the process, the judge urged them to not be so specific about their about the names or other identifying information about their employers. But other than that, the information about them is public. It's a public court. The jury selection process and the voir dire happens in public. And that, you know, there are certain steps that the judge could have taken before this process started to make some of that information private, but he chose not to. So
we'll see. Hopefully they won't be subject to any harassment or doxing of any kind with the steps the judge has taken to protect their privacy. But on the media diets, the big winner here was the New York Times, hands down. Of the 12 jurors plus 6 alternates, and we are talking about 18 people, not 12. 12 jurors plus 6 alternates is what they pick. So of those 18, 13 of them said they get news from the New York Times. Nothing else remotely came close. Next is Google, which, as you may know, Erica, is not really a news organization, with 5 jurors mentioning it. That was the second most cited. Then the Wall Street Journal with 4. And nothing else with more than 2. Only one person cited Fox News, and that person also reads The Times and The Daily Mail. Only one cited Truth Social, 2 cited TikTok as their main source of news. Good luck with that. And there was one who listed WNYC. And that person also reads The Washington Post, The Wall Street Journal, and The Times, and The New York Post. So really, folks, that's where we want to be, a station for people who seek to broadly inform themselves of news and multiple points of view. Politico is not one of the choices the court gave the jurors, so you don't have to be embarrassed about it not showing up. But do you make anything of this list in terms of understanding the jury pool and how the lawyers on either side did at seating people to their advantage?
Well, one thing that information doesn't capture was that a lot of people said that they don't really pay that much attention to news generally, but then ended up naming, you know, sort of tossing out some publications that they end up reading when they want to find out about something specific or something like that. So that although what you just detailed is accurate, it kind of doesn't incorporate that aspect of the proceedings. But I mean, it does seem that there's a pretty broad range, wide range of news sources that you just described. And it seems like they ended up with people who get their news from all sorts of places. And, you know, there are people who said they follow, you know, Michael Cohen on X and Donald Trump on, you know, Truth Social, things like that. But that they, you know, it didn't sound from the way they described their news consumption that they're sort of sitting there watching these people, you know, update their feeds every every 3 seconds. But that they're sort of like passive consumers of these things.
Right. And the one Fox News viewer also watches MSNBC, I noticed.
Right.
And consume some other stuff. So what's your larger impression of the jury in terms of what they actually landed on for who they would seat? And, there, you know, there has to be a certain amount of agreement between both sides. And,
right.
And if you have an impression of other characteristics of the jury, we've been talking about their media diet so far because I think it's interesting. But are there other characteristics of the jury that you think are relevant to the potential outcome of the case or to the defense and prosecution strategy to name?
Well, one thing is that that many of them seem relatively well educated and, you know, have successful careers or careers that required them to have higher education, things like that.
Demographically, so, not usually good for Trump, right?
Not. I would say typically not usually. There were, as you might expect, people on sort of either extreme of people who appeared to be on either extreme of the political spectrum that got cut. So we don't have a lot of those on this jury. And there are a couple of people who were not born in the United States who made the jury. I don't know whether that'll have an impact or not, but just sort of something to note. But yeah, beyond that, I mean, it was interesting to see the process because there were the Trump lawyers did, as you might have seen if you were following this, a lot of deep dives on the prospective jurors' social media accounts and sort of ended up confronting a lot of them with old posts that they had made or pictures that they had taken. And they got a fair number of people kicked off that way.
Yeah, and that actually goes to a text that we just got from a listener who writes, the information on jurors' news sources is all self-reported, right? The listener writes, there's no way to know how much of it is true. And sure enough, didn't they dismiss at least one juror who was going to be seated after doing a little further investigation into their truthfulness?
Yes. I mean, that wasn't with regard, I don't believe, to their media consumption. But yes,
right.
They did. There were a couple of instances, actually, where they confronted a prospective juror after they had answered the questionnaire. And there was one who comes to mind who said, I believe it was someone who said that he hadn't attended any I think it was characterized as anti-Trump rallies. And the Trump lawyers found pictures he had taken that appeared to be from a rally. I think it was shortly after the 2016 election.
Huh.
And, you know, his response was that the rally was, you know, happening right outside. It happened to be happening sort of right where he lived. And so he went down and his interest was just sort of like photographing it and being part of the, you know, I think he described it as like a New York experience. But nevertheless, he was let go.
So maybe that one juror made up that they listened to WNYC because they just wanted to be associated with thoughtfulness and being a generally good person. I'm kidding. All right. To the content. How would you sum up the opening arguments?
Well, in my opinion, they were relatively brief. As someone, I mainly cover federal court and usually sort of public corruption trials, and those opening statements tend to be quite long. These were only about 40, I think there were about 40 minutes on the prosecution side and maybe 20 to 30 minutes on the defense side. But, you know, the prosecutors certainly went out of their way to describe this as an election fraud trial, that their the main thrust of their opening statement was that all of these steps that they described that Donald Trump took were in service of improperly influencing the 2016 election. They did not, they sort of made it very clear that they don't consider this a quote unquote hush money trial. And on the defense side, Trump's lawyer, Todd Blanche, really sought to normalize a lot of the conduct that prosecutors described as illegal or improper, including, as you mentioned, the catch and kill schemes, the hush money payments, the reimbursement payments to Michael Cohen. Blanche really over and over told the jury that these were normal and sort of routine things to do if you're running for president.
And remind us of what the prosecution has to prove here, Erica, to win a felony conviction.
Well, they have to prove that Donald Trump orchestrated orchestrated and or ordered the false business records to be recorded by the Trump Organization regarding his what they describe as his reimbursement of the hush money to Michael Cohen.
Is it one of the potentially weakest parts of the prosecution's case? Because correct me if I'm wrong, but I understand that this falsifying of business records in and of itself would be a misdemeanor unless it's done in the process of covering up or aiding the defendant in another crime. And the underlying crime that makes this falsifying business records potentially a felony, that crime he's allegedly trying to cover up was never charged, and it too is a misdemeanor?
Well, first of all, prosecutors don't have to specify what they believe the underlying crime is. However, during the course of the trial, they've sort of made it clear that the most likely suspect, if you will, is this conspiracy to influence the 2016 election.
Right, if it's an election.
That has to do with New York election law.
Yeah, if they're characterizing it as an election fraud case, then they have to show, I guess, or they intend to show, that falsifying the business records about the hush money payments was to cover up an election fraud. Am I missing something?
No, that's right. But the judge is going to instruct the jury on all of this. And I don't think the jury, unless they're researching this on their own, which they shouldn't be, they're not going to be told that they need to concern themselves with whether this underlying election fraud was charged or not.
Right.
So, I mean, there are some lawyers on the jury. So those people...
Huh. There are lawyers on the jury?
Yes.
I'm shocked that either side would take lawyers on the jury.
Yes. So those people may know a little something about this, but, you know, they all pledged during the jury selection to essentially set their legal knowledge aside and follow the judge's instructions and and base their decisions only on the evidence that is put before them.
I assume there are no journalists on the jury, correct?
There are not, no.
too curious, too skeptical.
yeah.
Now, am I right that a basis of Trump's defense is going to be that, yeah, he was trying to hide the hush money payments to Stormy Daniels, but not for the sake of his election campaign, rather just to keep it from Melania?
That's right. His lawyer made that argument during opening statements. He essentially said, yes, he wanted to keep this allegation. Well, first he described the allegation as false. And he said, yes, he wanted to keep this allegation out of the public because he wanted to protect his family. He wanted to protect his business. He wanted to protect his reputation. So that is absolutely one of their lines of defense.
And so the prosecution has to show, because the burden is on the prosecution in a criminal trial to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, in this case as in any other case, they have to demonstrate that Trump was doing this in pursuit of enhancing his chances of getting elected, not just protecting his marriage or embarrassment from people in his personal life. And to that end, they started with their first witness, David Pecker from the National Enquirer. Why David Pecker?
Well, David Pecker is absolutely central to this entire alleged scheme because, as prosecutors describe it, it started with this 2015 meeting in Trump Tower between David Pecker, Donald Trump, and Michael Cohen. And at that meeting, according to prosecutors, and according to David Pecker, the three of them agreed that they would enter into sort of, as David Pecker described it, this mutually beneficial relationship where Pecker would have his publication, the National Enquirer, run flattering stories about Donald Trump. And as he said, his audience absolutely loved stories about Donald Trump. So that worked out great for him. That he would also run negative stories about Donald Trump's opponents. And prosecutors presented a couple of National Enquirer headlines to that effect yesterday. And the third component of this agreement was that David Pecker would, when he heard about potential unflattering stories about Donald Trump, that he would bring them to Michael Cohen's attention and the two would decide what to do about it. And what they did about it was buy the stories and bury them.
And this is to establish a pattern, because he didn't do this with Stormy Daniels, or he did?
The Stormy Daniels arrangement ended up being a bit different because so far on the stand, David Pecker has only been asked about two other sort of catch and kill arrangements, one involving a former Trump Tower doorman and the other involving a former Playboy model named Karen McDougal. In both of those cases, AMI, American Media Inc., which was the company that David Pecker ran that published the National Enquirer, the company actually paid the hush money in those cases, signed the NDAs with these people and paid the hush money. In the Stormy Daniels situation, Pecker did bring the Stormy Daniels story to Donald Trump and to Michael Cohen. But ultimately, as a lot of people now know, Cohen is the one who paid Stormy Daniels, not AMI.
All right. In a minute, I'm going to ask you why Trump's friend Pecker, because they claim to be friends, turned on him, if that's the way to look at his testimony for the prosecution. But I have to take this call about a former juror's experience, which looks like it might be very interesting and relevant. Jane in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Thank you for calling in. Hi, Jane.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was on a jury in Manhattan about 25 years ago. This was the late 90s. And the defendant was Donald Trump. And in the voir dire process, the jury pool was asked what we thought of Donald Trump. And there was almost no one in that jury pool who had a favorable opinion of him. After all, we were New Yorkers, and Trump has never been particularly popular here. We were then asked if, nevertheless, we could judge the case fairly based on the facts presented at trial and the law. And those of us who were chosen said yes. So very similar to what we're hearing about the jury selection process in the present case. The other thing, however, which I find interesting about my experience, this was a case that involved a dispute about contract law, and specifically a licensing agreement. And of the people who were chosen for that jury, there were two of us who actually had copyright and licensing experience. Hmm. Now, normally you would say you want to keep people with relevant experience off the jury, which is a similar argument that we've heard with regard to the lawyers who are on the current jury.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that in that case, both sides felt that we, the jury, needed to understand the sort of subtle legal nuances of contract law on which the case would ultimately hinge.
Mm-hmm.
And I suspect that the attorneys on both sides in the current trial are making a similar calculation.
Yeah, that's a really interesting piece of speculation. I presume this was a civil case, because I believe this is the first time...
This was a civil case,
First time he's ever been criminally charged. And so who won?
We found for Trump.
Hmm.
We actually felt that the guy who was suing him was doing so very opportunistically, and we felt, you know, quite simply, it did come down to the contract law that was being applied, and we felt that Trump did not have a binding contract with the plaintiff, and therefore we acquitted him.
Wow.
So I will say, in the current trial, there were some instances similar to what you described at the start of your comments, where there were people who said they didn't like Trump, but they felt that they could put their opinions of him aside and decide the trial fairly on the evidence. And one of those people who said, you know, she said outright that she didn't like him, that she thought he was selfish. And I believe the line was selfish and self-serving. She made it onto the jury. She's one of the jurors. So
really interesting. Jane, thank you so much for your really insightful addition to this conversation. Please call us again. That really was fascinating, Erica. And when she talked about the outcome, that they found that the person, you know, was being, what was the word, opportunistic in filing this lawsuit. Isn't that part of what they intend to use against Stormy Daniels? Not that she's suing Trump in this case, but I know there are Trump supporters who say, hey, Stormy Daniels herself should be charged with a crime here, extortion, for extracting a six-figure payment from Donald Trump, knowing that he was running for president, or to keep it from his wife, in order to keep quiet.
Well, there are people who say that, certainly. I will say that, yes, I believe it was yesterday, it must have been during opening statements. Sorry, forgive me. Todd Blanche attempted to go down that road, and he was stopped. The prosecution objected to him trying to mention to the jury that Stormy Daniels' behavior was attempted extortion, and the judge sustained that objection.
I said I was going to ask you the question about why Pecker is a witness for the prosecution. Is it right to say that Pecker turned on him to become a prosecution witness? Is there a immunity deal or something here?
Well, he said he was there pursuant to a subpoena. He did testify to that. David Pecker is one of the most interesting witnesses, not just because he's at the center of this, but because he really hasn't spoken about this publicly at all. And this is the first time really anyone is hearing him describe his involvement in this. And he was, as I said, very, very close to this. He doesn't, certainly on the stand, he doesn't sound... vindictive or anything like that. He doesn't sound like he's there to bury Donald Trump. But his testimony is going to be critical to the prosecution if they want a conviction.
If the Michael Cohen testimony is going to be the main event, when do you expect it?
That's a good question. We don't know. prosecutors have been very reluctant to say when the order of witnesses or give any information about witnesses at all. They, you know, have said that they're very concerned that Donald Trump will, you know, make this information public, that he'll put it on his Truth Social posts, things like that. So they have not said when that's going to be. If I had to guess, I would say it'd be soon, maybe right after David Pecker. But I don't know.
Erica Orden, covering the Trump criminal trial, the first of its kind, not the last, in Manhattan for Politico. Thank you very much for joining us and breaking it down.
Thank you so much for having me.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.